Otto Carver by Jonathan Coe. Adapted by David Nobbs. Episode 3.
I'd been trying to trace a private detective called Findlay Onyx. He'd been involved in the strange happenings at Winshaw Towers, the ancestral home of the family whose story I'd been commissioned to write. I'd also been trying to shake off a mysterious man who'd been following me. In the end, I slipped into a dark alley and jumped out on him. It worked. I was better at this kind of thing than I'd expected.
All right, then. Who the hell are you and what's your game?
My name is Findlay Onyx.
Imagine my surprise when I discovered that he was the very man I'd been trying to find.
Good Lord, you're the very man I've been trying to find. And what is this overwhelming scent?
Jasmine. I won't douse myself in it.
There is no jasmine in our garden.
It's jasmine. Isn't it lovely?
There's no jasmine round here, is there?
That was one mystery solved, anyway.
Why have you been following me, Mr. Onyx?
Please call me Findlay. I'm sure we're going to be friends.
Friends?
I couldn't help noticing, following you, that you have very firm buttocks.
I beg your pardon?
For a writer.
You know who I am, then?
That's the whole point.
I don't follow you.
Of course you don't. I follow you. This is a ridiculous conversation to be having in a dark alley, Michael.
You know my name?
It's a cold night for an old man. May I come into your flat?
Why on earth should I invite a dirty old man who stinks of jasmine into my flat?
Because I have a great deal of information about the Winshaw family.
Can I get you something to drink, Findlay?
Oh, thank you, dear boy. A whiskey would slip down most pleasantly.
There you are. Anything with it?
Well, a drop more whiskey would be very nice. Thank you. Bottoms up.
Cheers. Findlay, am I right in thinking that you were at Winshaw Towers back in 1961, when an intruder was killed by Lawrence Winshaw, that you talked to Lawrence's sister Tabitha in the garden, and that you met her in her bedroom the next day?
How can you possibly know all that?
Tabitha's brother Mortimer smelt jasmine in a garden where there is no jasmine, and smelt it again in her room. And you have admitted that you douse yourself in the stuff.
Your prognostic powers defy belief, Michael. I must apologise. I've been wanting to make contact with you for some time. I approached you outside the Mandarin Chinese restaurant, where I was somewhat touched, if also rather hurt, to be mistaken for a tramp and given 20 pence by your charming companion.
But why all this dramatic business of following me?
Old habits die hard, and I am very shy. Michael, I also have to confess that it was I who broke into the offices of your remarkable publishers and pilfered your manuscript.
Good Lord, but why?
As you have already surmised, I have for many years been deeply interested in the case of Miss Tabitha Winshaw.
Who commissioned my book.
She did? Well, this is extraordinary. I regard her long confinement in an asylum as the most shocking injustice I have ever encountered. I have neglected Tabitha's case shamefully. My career, you see, has frequently had to be suspended for reasons of, well, pleasure.
Pleasure?
Her Majesty's pleasure, to be precise. I've spent a goodly portion of my life in prison. My libido, Michael, gets stronger and stronger with age. Speaking of that, it's cold out. May I sleep here tonight? It is very late.
It's only 8:40. Certainly not.
You have a cruel streak.
Please, stick to the point, Findlay.
You mentioned in your narrative that Tabitha grabbed a piece of paper from Lawrence, which she claimed to be evidence of his treachery in sending Godfrey Winshaw to his death over Germany in 1942. I have been unable to find this note, but if it proves Lawrence guilty, it will go a long way towards finding Tabitha sane.
I have this note.
You have it? Well, how did you succeed where I, the fabled, the infamous, the redoubtable Findlay Onyx, failed?
I asked Mortimer Winshaw for it, and he gave it to me.
The economy of your methods astounds me. And?
It is what Mortimer said it was. Nothing more than a request for a light supper to be brought to Lawrence's room.
Nevertheless, I should like to examine it. I may see some clue that an amateur might miss. Will you show it to me in exchange for this information, which I...
Michael! Are you there?
Fiona! Oh, Lord, I'd forgotten her. Fiona!
Are you all right? I've been so worried.
Fine, I'm fine. Come in, meet Findlay Onyx. Findlay, this is Fiona. Fiona, this is Findlay Onyx. He's a private detective.
Good evening, dear lady.
Oh, terrific. We're followed home. You go off on your own to trap this man. I'm worried sick because I... Well, because I care about you, and here you are having a cosy drink and a chat, not... You're not thinking about me at all. I see. Now I see how much you care about me, Michael.
I'm sorry, Fiona, I'm sorry, but this really is rather important. As are you, of course, yes, as are you. Say something, Finlay Duplicator.
Here's the 20 pence I owe you, Fiona. Surely you remember you were kind enough to give it to an old bugger outside the Chinese restaurant.
Don't you mean an old beggar?
No, sadly, I don't.
I think you should go now, Finlay. I have something to discuss with my Fiona.
Look after your Fiona, Michael. She doesn't look at all well to me.
Finlay saw straight away what I had failed to see, probably because I didn't want to see it. Even then, I didn't do anything about it. I was too busy appeasing Fiona, or attempting to. I'm sorry, Fiona.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
It does. I think you expect too much of me. Everyone seems to expect too much of me.
Perhaps because there's so little to you.
Oh, ouch.
You're hopeless. You're heartless. You can't even be bothered to look after the plants I gave you. They're withering. Look at that cineraria. Dying, Michael. And you don't give a damn.
Oh, I'm sorry, Fiona. I don't think plants are my strong point.
Oh, what is your strong point, Michael?
When Fiona had gone, I felt a loneliness more intense than any I had yet experienced. I tried to concentrate my thoughts on the Winshaws. Tomorrow I would begin my detailed research into Henry Winshaw, now Lord Winshaw. But I'd be beginning by interviewing Alan Beamish, the same Alan Beamish whom Hillary had sacked so cruelly. And Alan's connection with Henry had been uncovered for me by Fiona. And that set me thinking about her again. Oh, she was my eyes and ears, and I'd failed her. I could hear her dry cough again across the corridor. I knew what I should do. Oh, Fiona, I love you. Let's make love. Anywhere. In bed, on your dining table, beside your hibiscus, which looks so healthy. Anywhere.
Oh, Michael. At last.
I didn't, of course. I don't do things like that. I went to bed and slept badly. And in the morning, I went to see Alan Beamish.
Yes, I know Henry Winshaw only too well, Michael. In fact, I interviewed him twice on television. The first time was back in 1961 for a feature called Backbencher, in which we sought the views of obscure backbenchers. An income much more obscure than Henry Winshaw, Conservative MP for the safe seat of Bagwell in King's Marsh. Wet behind the ears, and in several other places. I have a tape of it, as it happens.
Welcome, Henry Winshaw.
Thank you. Now, what the opposition fails to understand...
Just a moment, Mr. Winshaw. You were born in Yorkshire, I believe, in your family's ancestral mansion. You held the post of executive chairman on the board of Lambert and Cox. You were elected to Parliament in 1955, but have retained your position with Lambert and Cox, and in addition, you've continued to serve as an active board member with Spraggan Textiles and Daintree Limited.
Well, I believe it's very important to maintain contact with the manufacturing process at grassroots level, as it were. Now, what the opposition fails to understand...
Before we come to that, I thought we should perhaps consider things in a more global perspective. The revolution in Iraq has dominated proceedings in the Commons for the last few days. You must have been following the debates with interest.
Ah. Well, I haven't been in the House this week nearly as much as one would wish. Business commitments, constituency business, of course, have been very, very pressing.
Do you think Mr. Macmillan will face any problem in recognising the new government?
Oh, I'm sure he'd know them if he saw them.
No, my point, Mr. Winshaw, my point is that there is concern in some quarters about the effect that the violent impositions of a new left-wing regime will have on our trading prospects with Iraq, and indeed on our relations generally.
Ah, well, I personally don't have any relations in Iraq, but anybody who does would be well advised, I'd have thought, to get them flown home at once.
Let me put it another way. There's been considerable disquiet in the House over Mr. Macmillan's decision to send British troops into the area. Do you think we could now be faced with another Suez?
No, I don't, and I'll tell you why. The Suez, you see, is a canal, A very large canal, as I understand it, running through Egypt. Now, there are no canals in Iraq. Absolutely none at all. So I don't really think the comparison stands up to scrutiny.
Well, I see that we're now out of time. Henry Winshaw, thank you very much for being our guest on the programme. And now, over to Alistair for his location report.
Is there a bar in here?
We're still on air, I think.
Oh.
You wouldn't have given him a cat's chance of a political career after that, would you?
No, not a cat's chance. He sounds like a total idiot.
Well, nevertheless, he smartened up his act. He realised that true power lies behind the scenes, and made his life into a personal crusade for the reformation of the National Health Service.
I know, yeah. My father might not have died if the ambulance hadn't had to take him 45 miles after his heart attack because of Henry's bloody reforms. I hate the Winshaws.
Don't, Michael. Hillary destroyed my career. I could hate her, but she wouldn't care, so my hatred would only hurt me. Hatred corrodes the one who hates. It doesn't touch the one who is hated. Now, you've no doubt read my book, A Pox on the Box, Memoirs of a Disillusioned Broadcaster.
No.
Oh. Well, actually, I haven't read your novels either, come to that. Well, in A Pox on the Box, I quoted my other interview with Henry 27 years later, face to face with Jane Gilliam, a very eloquent junior doctor. It was almost impossible to connect that nervous, fresh-faced MP with the puffy, glowering old firebrand who stared at me across the table, thumping it with his fist and looking like a rabid dog.
I suggest that you're deliberately underfunding the NHS as a prelude to privatisation.
Underfunding? 17 million over 5 years, 12.3% of GDP, 4% more than the EU, 35% up on the USSR, seasonally adjusted 12,900,000 plus 54.67 and 19%, including VAT rising to 47%, depending on IPR. You call that underfunding?
I don't dispute your figures, but neither do I dispute the truth of what I see every day with my own two eyes. And the problem is, these two truths contradict each other. Every day I see staff working longer hours under greater stress for less reward. And I see patients waiting a longer time for worse treatment under worse conditions. These are facts, I'm afraid. They can't be argued away.
You're forgetting the figures, Dr. Gilliam. 16%, 16.5%, rising to 17% under a DMU, with 54,000 extra for PAYE and SERPs. 64% PRP and £38,000 equals $45,000 plus 93 million yen, 45% IPR, 73% NUT, 85,999% CFC, and 9.5 weeks more than the last Labour government.
He left the studio, Michael, with the victorious air of a man who thinks he has finally conquered the media. And, I suppose, in a way, he had.
I secured an interview with Lord Winshaw at the Palace of Westminster. I must admit I was dreading it. But first, I craved more information from Findlay Onyx. I arranged to meet him in the pub where people of my persuasion, as he put it, hung out.
Have you brought that note about the light supper?
No, you said you'd like it in return for information. I haven't had any information yet. What do you know, Findlay, about the events at Winshaw Towers in 1942 and 1961?
I know no more about 1942 than you do. That Godfrey Winshaw flew to his death over Germany, and Tabitha Winshaw accused Lawrence, the head of the family, of betraying him, for which he's been incarcerated in a lunatic asylum. Except for that one night in 1961. And that's where I come in. Tabitha had probably still has a solicitor, name of Proudfoot, a local man, something deeply unprepossessing and untrustworthy about his buttocks. A man, I would say, unscrupulous enough to be swayed by the thought of all that Winshaw money lying around in high-interest accounts.
And he was the one who first approached you? That was how you came to be involved with the Winshaws?
You anticipate me superbly. Early in 1961, this Proudfoot chap turned up at my office, bearing a message from Tabitha herself. She had a job for me. When Godfrey's plane was shot down, there was a co-pilot. Tabitha had decided that she wanted to trace the unfortunate man's family and make some sort of financial reparation, by the way of atonement, as she saw it, for the treachery carried out by her brother. So my job was to find his family.
Which I have no doubt you managed to do.
Thank you, Michael. Your faith in me thrills me to the marrow. If only you... No. Yes, I found his family and I went one better. I found the man himself.
The co-pilot?
Yes. I found him alive and well and living in Birkenhead. His name was John Farrington. And John Farrington was the man that Lawrence Winshaw bludgeoned to death that night in 1961.
I see. Except, I don't see. How did he survive the crash?
Parachuted to safety at the last moment.
Does that mean... Did it mean that Godfrey was still alive?
Sadly, no. Mr. Farrington had himself seen Godfrey consumed by flames. Good Lord, I know that man who's just come in. His name's Martin. He has very firm buttocks. For an accountant.
Finlay.
Hello, Martin.
Hello, Finlay. Who's your friend?
Oh, a business acquaintance only, Martin. I'm quite free this evening, if you'll excuse me, Michael.
But Finlay, the events at Winshaw Towers in 1961...
More than 20 years have passed. Another day won't make much difference. Off we go then, Martin.
It had been madness to meet Finlay in a gay pub. I was ashamed of my naivety. I wanted to talk about it all to Fiona, but I didn't know what sort of reception I'd get after our last meeting. I tried to watch the news, but the lure of what a carve-up was irresistible.
Miss, you don't happen to know where my bedroom is, do you?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'll go now.
No, hang on. Turn your back a minute. Oh,
she had very firm buttocks for an actress. No, it's catching. Damn you, Finlay.
Hello, Michael.
Come in.
Thanks. Michael, I came to apologise. I didn't mean to be so rude last night.
That's all right.
I wish we didn't argue.
We'll never argue again.
Words are cheap. If that's your mother, I'm going to speak to her.
Don't you dare. No, Fiona.
Let go of me.
No.
I want to speak to her.
No!
Michael, it's me. Speak to me. I love you.
You should talk to her, Michael. Whatever's happened between you, you heard what she said. She loves you.
Yeah. Words are cheap. You said so yourself.
Yeah, you tell me. You tell me what's behind it all.
I will. I will, Fiona.
When?
Soon. When I can.
Next day, I took a taxi to the Nirvana Press to deliver my chapter on Hilary Winshaw. As the taxi approached Vanity House, I began to hope that this time I would see Alice Hastings. Not that I was obsessed by her anymore. After all, I was beginning to fall in love with Fiona. More in love, perhaps, than I'd ever been. But it would be nice to see Alice again. Somehow, though, I wasn't surprised that yet again I found myself dealing with the middle-aged, business-like Hortensia Tonks. I decided to be strong and dignified. I wouldn't even mention Alice Hastings.
Oh, hello, Hortensia. I've brought another chapter of my book.
Excellent. You're a quick worker.
I was wondering... sorry, is Alice in today at all?
She's on jury service. You'll have to make do with me for a while.
Oh, I have to make do with you even when she isn't on jury service.
If you're unhappy with me...
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. It was rude.
I've a good mind not to get the little present I had for you.
Oh, my God, more of their dreadful books. Oh, that's a shame.
But I mustn't be petty.
Damn. Oh, good.
Three of our very latest volumes.
Ah. A History of Greek Drainage. Oh, thank you. And Great Buildings of Croydon, with three black and white illustrations.
And Plinths, Plinths, Plinths by the Reverend J.W. Pottage. There, Michael. Alice is forgotten already, isn't she?
I took a taxi from Vanity House to the Houses of Parliament to meet Lord Winshaw. It would be hard to prise any information out of the man. He was very powerful now and very wily, and I was nervous.
£6, Squire.
Give me a receipt for £6.50.
Thank you, sir. Oh, sir, you left your books.
Huh? Oh, thank you.
There were no rubbish bins anywhere near the Houses of Parliament. Security, I suppose. I waited 20 minutes for Lord Winshaw, my reading matter getting heavier by the second.
Michael, so sorry to keep you waiting. I've been sitting on the Fruit Ripening Advisory Committee.
The so-called Mango Quango. Come into my office. We can be frank there. You can ask me anything you like.
Thank you, Your Lordship.
Please, Michael, no formalities. Plain sir will suffice. Sit you down.
Thank you, you pompous bastard. Thank you, sir. Sir, will you tell me about your relationship with Margaret Thatcher?
Certainly. I was at Oxford with her. She was called Margaret Roberts then, and she was an absolute pip. An utterly gorgeous head of nut-brown hair. I just wanted to bury myself in it. She spoke to me once, and I to her.
Can you remember the conversation?
Every word, Michael.
Even after all these years?
Even after all these years. She said, "You're standing on my foot." And I said, "Oh, dear, I'm frightfully sorry." Imagine my astonishment when I turned up at the house in 1960 for the second reading of the public body's admission of the Preston Meetings Bill, and it was the maiden speech of the selfsame Margaret Roberts. Now, Margaret Thatcher. A magnificent debut. A magnificent woman.
May I ask you, sir, what your advice was when you were questioned about your allegiance in the recent battle for the leadership of the Conservative Party?
Clearly you have done your research and know the answer, if not the exact words. Well, I'm not ashamed to tell you the exact words. I said, "Ditch the bitch." She'd become unelectable, you see.
You felt no loyalty?
I felt enormous loyalty, Michael. The only loyalty that matters, Michael, the loyalty to my country, Michael.
So if Tabitha turns out to be right, and your Uncle Lawrence did betray his brother Godfrey, and I'm well on the way to finding this out, that would be pretty serious for you, wouldn't it? Your family's reputation would be in tatters.
Uncle Lawrence did not betray Godfrey. Tabitha is mad! Good God, man! She attacked Uncle Lawrence with candlesticks, golf umbrellas, butter knives, razor blades, riding crops, a loofah, a mashie, a niblick, an Afghan hunting horn of considerable antiquarian value, a chamber pot and a bazooka. Are those the actions of a reasonable woman? I was there, Michael, young and impressionable. It was the worst day of my life. Tabitha is mad! I'm sorry. We loved him, Michael. He was the best of us.
Changing tack, sir, may I ask you about your NHS reforms?
With pleasure, Michael. My philosophy can be summed up in the notice I pinned to the wall there.
Freedom, competition, choice. Well, my father didn't have much choice when he had his heart attack. It was 45 miles to the nearest casualty unit, thanks to your reforms.
Keep calm, Michael. That was essential centralisation to ensure that his provider unit had the very best modern facilities.
Sorry. What is a provider unit?
The old-fashioned word banned in my office is hospital. All right, 10 years earlier, your father could have been a customer at a nearer provider unit, but might not have received such expert treatment.
But he wasn't a customer, he was a patient.
In future, he will come to be known as a customer.
He doesn't have a future, he's dead.
That's not the point I'm making. And, of course, I'm sorry he's dead. But the hospital will become a shop, Michael. The operational will become a piece of merchandise. Normal business practices will prevail. Pile them high and sell them cheap. The beautiful simplicity of the idea astounds me.
And me.
Sell-offs are proceeding at an amazing rate. Aerospace, Seedlink, Vickers Shipyards and British Gas in the last year alone. The NHS can't be far off. You see, the British public has a short memory. The trick is to keep doing outrageous things before the public has a chance to work out what's hit 'em.
You're being astonishingly frank, sir.
Why should I not be? Nothing you can write in your little book can worry me.
Would you say you're close to the rest of your family, sir?
We relatives do each other little favours, Michael. Hillary's articles help sell my policies. Thomas's bank can provide millions in exchange for a bit of advance information. Dorothy keeps the public undernourished, which helps keep them docile, etc., etc. Little things that any family would do.
But do you like them?
Extraordinary question. Never really looked at it like that. Like them? No, to me, they're just shits that pass in the night. That's rather good. You could use that in your little book. Shits that pass in the night.
After my interview with Henry Winshaw, I felt dirty. I longed to see Fiona. I longed for the purity of her friendship, to wash me clean. I hoped that perhaps tonight, for the first time, we would...
Do you know anyone who might be following you, Gov?
No? Why?
Oh, I think there's a geezer on our tail.
A blue Citroen and 2CV?
No, Squire, a black Mercedes. I'll try and shake him off.
Stupid of me to think that Findlay would still be following me. Why should he now? Unless the taxi driver had unusually firm buttocks. For a taxi driver. No, Michael, no, don't mock Findlay. You need him, for all his faults.
There's no doubt about it, mate. He is on your tail. He's very professional, very discreet. A skilled operator. Dangerous. You want to watch out, Gav?
An unpleasant thought struck me. Henry had been astonishingly frank, far franker than I'd expected. Perhaps he believed I would not survive to finish my little book. Oh, I didn't like having them on my tail. I felt very small and vulnerable. Oh, Fiona. Fiona, comfort me. Comfort me, my darling.
Hello, Michael. I've brought a little fuchsia for you.
She was wearing an old jumper and a pair of jeans. I could see she was going to ask me something important. I felt my excitement rising. Any man would. But when the question came, it could not have been further from my hopes.
Do you think you could fill my throat?
Your throat?
Just touch it. Touch it and tell me what you think.
I traced a slow line, sensing a film of fine, downy hair. As I touched the soft ridges of her throat, Fiona remained perfectly still and perfectly quiet. Like that.
Again, to the left.
Well, I can feel something. A small obstruction. It's a ball of hardness about the size of an olive. Does it hurt?
No.
What is it?
I don't know.
Have you been to see your doctor?
Yeah, but he didn't seem very interested.
Have you always had it?
No. I noticed it a few weeks ago.
Is it growing?
Well, it's hard to say. I really am tired, Michael. I must go.
Before she went, I put my hand against her neck again, and we slid into an embrace, which was clumsy at first, but it didn't matter. We persisted, and by the end we were clasping each other tightly. I clung to her silence, and pictured a knot made from the threads of her wordless fears and my famished longing, which would hold up fast against the very worst that the future and the Winshaws might throw at us.
What a Carve Up starred Robert Bathurst as Michael, with Fiona Allen as Fiona, Gus Brown as Alan Beamish, Flaminia Cinque as Hortensia, Charlie Higson as Findlay, and Jeff Rawle as Henry. What a Carve Up was produced by Lucy Armitage for Tiger Aspect Productions.